Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode number 78, recorded July 15th, 2010. America needs your money. This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Carbonite Pro. With prices starting at $10 a month, all of your office PCs can be backed up safely and automatically. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. It's Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I am your host, Ryan Shrout, joined by your other host, Patrick Norton. Patrick, how are you doing this evening?
I'm trying not to make another white meat joke.
That's good. I would appreciate it. This is a family show still.
Hey, there's nothing that's not family friendly about pork, Ryan.
I agree. I don't eat enough of it as far as I'm concerned. No one's around. My mom doesn't make pork chops or anything for me anymore, so I feel like I'm missing out. But we're not here to talk about food, unfortunately. We are here to talk about computer hardware, what it means to you, what might be breaking in your system, how we might suggest you fix it. But first, we're going to talk about some new stuff, some cool stuff.
New graphics cards.
New graphics cards. And so this is one example I'm going to show you right here. Now, this is not a reference card, meaning this is not one that we got straight from NVIDIA. This is one that we got from one of NVIDIA's partners. In this particular instance, this is from a company called Galaxy. Might be new to some people, but they've actually been around for quite a while, manufacturing cards, not really branding them for anything, any other purpose. So this is the new GeForce GTX 460 graphics card. And what makes this card interesting is not the fact that it's in a plastic case that kind of looks like a military box shell casing holder or something like that. It's the GPU inside of it. So the GTX 460 is interesting because it is the first major revision of NVIDIA's Fermi architecture. Fermi is the DirectX 11 part, otherwise known as GF100, otherwise known as GTX 480 and GTX 470 and GTX 465 graphics cards. We've talked about them on this show. I'm sure most people who are watching this or listening to this have seen reviews, seen articles about the family of products from NVIDIA based around Fermi architecture. And the problem that people had with NVIDIA's GPUs, this latest line of graphics cards, was not their performance. They perform very well, and their pricing was competitive with AMD's parts, very competitive, in fact. What the problem had that people had was with power consumption, heat, noise, all things that are all very associated with one another, right? Usually, if you have a very hot chip, you have a very noisy fan, and you have a very high power consumption part.
It's just a vicious cycle, people.
It is. And while none of those things are really indicative about what kind of performance you're going to get or kind of value for your performance that you're going to get,
Still annoying.
They're still annoying, right? And a lot of people take them into consideration. If you have four PCs running in your office, it's always nice not to have them pumping out gallons and gallons of hot air.
What's your air conditioning bill in January like? Because didn't you tell me you had like 38?
You mean, so right now, we've had several PCs running all day, and air conditioning is having trouble getting below 77 degrees in the building, which I'm trying to get to because it's a little warm right now. The benefit of renting an office where all of your utilities are included, Patrick, is that I don't have to look at the air conditioning bill.
Yeah, that makes it somewhat more affordable, doesn't it? Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. I didn't mean to digress there, but it was just one of those moments where I was like, as I've been there, like I worked in a building where the AC shut off at 6:30 and the temperature in the lab would be up over 85 within an hour.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Not at all.
I wouldn't, that would be a problem for me. I do most of my work after five anyway. So what's interesting about the GTX 460, although it's only 5 points lower than the GTX 465 that's been for sale since, you know, the March, April, May timeframe, the GTX 460 is actually a brand new GPU. If you go to my review that I wrote on PC Perspective, you will see pictures, you know, to kind of doing the classic. Here's a standard American quarter next to the graphics processor. So this way you can compare the size of the GPUs from chip to chip. That being said, it is noticeably smaller. It goes from 3 billion transistors to 1.95 billion transistors. So that's still a lot of transistors, but we're talking about like a 50% cut in die size there. And they didn't just kind of take the GPU, cut 50% off, and say, here you go with the part. They actually did a fair amount of re-architecting in terms of balancing shader units with tessellation units, with texture units, and all the kinds of bits that make up the GPU inside and help indicate what kind of performance levels you're going to get and that kind of thing. They did a fair amount of re-architecting, and what they did was... somebody said last night to me that what they did was Fermi was really built, the big version of Fermi, the 3 billion transistor chip, was really built for high performance computing, general purpose computing, not necessarily gaming. It was built for scientific computing and server workloads and you know, oil companies that want to use it and medical imaging companies that want to use it and that kind of stuff. But this chip, they have really kind of re-architected for games specifically. Mm-hmm. And because of that, what we are seeing is much better power efficiency for gaming workloads. Now, this is not a super high-end card. You're going to find these ranging from $199 to about $250, depending on what kind of frame buffer you get, 768 or 1 gig, and depending on if it's overclocked or if it's stock clock speeds. So we would consider this to be a mainstream graphics card, a mainstream gaming card, you know, kind of in that $200 price range. So it's lower performing than the GTX 480 and the GTX 470 based on the numbers. We would hope that would be the case. So it would be more confusing. It'd be like an Intel processor lineup or something like that. But it does very, very well for what it costs in relation to, I think, what people want to know is the ATI AMD $200 graphics card is the Radeon HD 5830, and the GTX 460 pretty much beats it across the board, sometimes by a significant margin.
This is a game changer for NVIDIA in this particular price segment. I mean, this makes NVIDIA not only becomes competitive, but they're actually taking a lead, which is, and maybe it's because I'm not, you know, following 3D graphics as tightly as I used to, but it seems like NVIDIA hasn't had a strong lead in a while in any of the normal price performance categories.
No, you'd be correct. Since the release of the AMD 4000 series of graphics cards, I would say that, yes, AMD had a significant advantage in kind of price performance, performance per watt, mind share with consumers, that kind of thing. And NVIDIA really struggled because their DX11 capable parts were very, very late as well. Right. The 5000 series came out in September of last year, and we didn't see our first NVIDIA DX11 ready parts until March. And that's, you know, you're talking about 6 or 7 months or so. In the world of graphics cards, that's a significant amount of time.
Where that's a generation. That's like a whole generation of rev, and hopefully getting at least one giant chunk of your user base to upgrade to the card that they just kind of missed out on.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now that NVIDIA has a full kind of family of these graphics cards, they are head to head. They're actually coming out ahead of AMD when we look at cost per. Performance per dollar, not in terms of performance per watt. They're still behind in that. NVIDIA has been aggressively kind of dropping prices, whereas AMD's prices have been almost identical since they were released in September, October, and November, which is a little bit unnerving. Hopefully we'll see AMD kind of react to these releases and drop some prices as well. But the GTX 460 is really the, you know, the $199 market is kind of like the meat for graphics card vendors, right? I mean, $600 graphics cards are great. $400 ones sell a little bit more, but really $200 is a significant portion. If you really want to get down to it, the $100 graphics card sells, you know, six or seven times as many as the $200 graphics cards. But those people usually aren't gamers in the strictest sense of the word, right? They're just people who think they need a new graphics card.
You're actually talking about aftermarket end user installed. Yes. You're not talking about OEM sales.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Because if we get into that, it's integrated graphics all the way and Intel wins. And, you know, that's a totally different debate. But, you know, it's been a long time since we've been able to say, like you were pointing to, it's like NVIDIA has the best option at point A. You know, bar none, NVIDIA is the best option there. And this GTX 460 does that. It's interesting. Now, you know, you can't support three monitors off of a single card like you can with the AMD cards. That's definitely a disadvantage. You can run a pair of these in SLI, and then you can do multi-monitor gaming that way. Otherwise, you're limited to two displays. The AMD cards have an integrated audio controller that works fantastically with their integrated HDMI output and that kind of stuff. Another little advantage. But this card in particular actually has mini HDMI. It's kind of interesting layout that they've got here. You can see they've got a pair of dual link DVI outputs, and then the smaller one it's hard to really see. It's a mini HDMI connection. And Galaxy actually includes a mini HDMI to HDMI cable, so you don't have to worry about that aspect of it or finding an adapter. The only other interesting part about this aftermarket one, now this is particular to Galaxies, is it has this interesting fold-out fan, right? And it's actually completely removable. You can disconnect the power cable there and take the fan off. Benefits to that being, you know, cleaning, being able to access the heatsink itself to clean that off a little bit better. Not a necessary feature, I would say, by any stretch of the imagination, but just kind of...
It's a nice gimme.
Yeah, how are they trying to differentiate at this point?
Well, they've obviously gone for the sort of aliens, industrial space marine kind of design with the flip-out fan that actually provides I mean, if you've ever cleaned half of your cat's, you know, previous 6 months of shedding out of your graphics card, you're probably looking at the idea of maybe not having to get out my jeweler's screwdrivers and spend the afternoon disassembling the fan. You know what I mean? Like, you've had that moment where you're, like, water cooling something and you're like, wow. 27 screws to hold the cover and the fan down. You know what I mean? Moments where you can tell that there's moments where I think graphics card engineers working on cooling, like on one hand, they're like, we're going to get the thermals. We're going to make it really, you know, we're going to make it overclockable, and we're going to see how many screws and really bizarre joints we can put into the thing.
So anything that they can do to kind of ease that is nice. The only other point I want to make about the GTX 460 is that keep an eye out for good deals on overclocked cards. This particular model runs at 700 megahertz, which is only a 25 megahertz increase over the standard clocks of 675. But there are models out there that are selling with 800 megahertz and 810 megahertz clock speeds on them, which is, you know, you're talking about 15 to 25% difference in clock speed. And that's going to translate almost directly to frame rate increases and playability increases in your games. You know, it's not kind of like overclocking your CPU may or may not affect what your gaming performance is, depending on whatever configuration you have. Overclocking your graphics card is almost always going to make a difference. And if you can get one of these cards with a gig of memory and running at 800 megahertz for $25 or $30 more than reference speeds, I would almost recommend going that route, because and overclocking and that kind of stuff, as opposed to doing it yourself. If you're comfortable doing it yourself, you know, you may not want to do that. But a great graphics card for people that, you know, don't want to spend $400, they don't want to spend $300, they're much more comfortable in the $200 range. That's pretty much it.
What's your pick for $100 graphics card now?
I would still, the AMD 5500 series of cards is still very, very good for that. NVIDIA has not yet been able to bring the Fermi architecture down to, and this is the lowest cost Fermi architecture card you can get. when you go to something beyond this, you are talking about a two-year-old design in terms of architecture and GPUs and that kind of thing. So AMD's 5500 series, I think, starts in the $89 to $120 range. And I think they offer a lot of good features, multi-monitor support, relatively good gaming and that kind of thing, DirectX 11 support for that type of $100 price segment for sure.
Good to know, sir.
You know what else is good to know, Patrick?
Intel's making ridiculous amounts of money.
When you can make a lot of money. Yeah.
Leading economic indicators trending up, which means we're all not going to be subsistence farming in 2 years. I think that's a huge plus. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like first the chip manufacturing equipment manufacturer orders start ramping up and Intel's orders start ramping up and all of a sudden, okay, we're not talking about oil company profits here, but Intel, that was a Freudian slip. this is their single best quarter in the history of the company.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I think we're having lag issues.
Yeah. The single best quarter they've ever had as a company in a quarter that is traditionally not supposed to be very good, right? Q2,
everybody's looking at the credit card receipts from Christmas and nobody's buying anything because, you know, they're saving up for their summer vacation. Q1, you still have people spending their Christmas money, but Q2 is a actually we are talking about oil company money, $10.77 billion in revenue. Oh, excuse me. Net income of $3 billion. So it's not quite oil company money yet.
Right. I mean, this is piddly compared to them, but
this is, yeah. Wow. AMD is only doing about $1.5 billion in revenue only.
Yes. Only
a mere $1.5 billion.
It kind of helps you put things in perspective when you realize that AMD's profit for this quarter is nearly 2x the gross revenue of AMD as a company. It really kind of, that whole David Goliath thing really kind of comes into focus when you see numbers like that.
It's also nice to know that a company that's so much smaller can so dramatically impact. I mean, you know, the current performance of Intel products is directly based on AMD kicking Intel's ass for a year or two.
Right.
And Intel stepping up to the challenge. I think, is it safe to say Pat Gelsinger primarily stepping up to the challenge and creating competitive engineering teams and scrapping architectures and all of this amazing processing power we're getting for, you know, it's literally exists. And also, I got to say, in the dark past, companies like Cyrix and who is long gone at this point, but Cyrix and AMD have kept Intel on their toes, making things affordable. So is this pent up? Do you think this is mostly corporate sales or consumer sales, or was it a blend? Or who's spending all this money?
I would say it's possible we're seeing a lot of residual Windows 7 upgrades at businesses is probably part of that. You know, you've got to look at Atom sales being still very, very high. I mean, I think we've kind of seen that peak in terms of the netbook market
phenomenon.
that is kind of slowly dying away as CULV and higher performance parts kind of creep into that. Right. But it's like anytime we talk about a market going up or down, Intel's always on top of it. So on one hand, Intel doesn't really care where people are buying computers if they're, as long as they're buying Intel-based computers. So, you know, the big worry for Intel in terms of financials at this point is ARM, cell phones, iPads, you know, slate things that may not be using Intel architectures. And that's why their push into the Morristown architecture and that type of thing, where they're desperately trying to get a foothold in that because, you know, I don't have
because all those iPhones and all those iPads are using ARM processors, or because the Apple processor is an ARM processor with modifications by a company that Apple bought because the ARM architecture is licensable. Intel's desperate to get a chunk of that market. Not quite as desperate as Microsoft is to get into the cell phone market in a big way, but certainly the sensation is there.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but look up how many computers are sold every year versus how many cell phones are sold every year, and you'll easily see why Intel is desperate to make their mark in that world. There was in this story by Josh posted on our site where we talk about this. He says there's some speculation that this high revenue in Q2 and high profit in Q2 for Intel is like a blip due to pent up spending needs. But Intel is forecasting higher revenues for Q3 and even higher revenues for Q4 as well. So, and you know, all the whole SEC thing, they're not just going to come out and lie. They're obviously basing those estimates on something. That doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be correct, but it is, yeah, it is out there. So
they have to be in the neighborhood of correct, not obviously outright lying.
Yes, exactly. The outright lying is the important part there. Let's take a quick break and thank today's sponsor of This Week in Computer Hardware, Carbonite Pro. Business PCs crash all the time, even those new ones that everybody's apparently buying and giving Intel cash for. These days, it's mostly because of hard drive failures, viruses, things that people download that they don't realize that they're downloading. But you can be sure to keep your business up and running, even if your computers aren't, with Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro will back up all of your PCs on the business automatically whenever they are connected to the internet. A few more things you should know about the service is it's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave your computer for maximum security. It's easy to use, whether you're a computer novice or a full-fledged techie. It's automatic. It backs up your files whenever you are online, as we've already said. It's affordable with prices starting at just $10 a month, and you only pay for the amount of backup you actually need. And it's one account with one monthly bill. Carbonite Pro gives you a centralized dashboard for you or your administrator to get a backup status summary of all the computers in your business. If there's ever a data loss problem, not only can you access that data as the administrator, but each employee themselves can actually access their own backup files for easy distribution. You can be notified whenever anything goes down, and your office can be up and running again with no headaches or time lost. And because your files are backed up offsite, each person can access their own files from any computer or even their iPhone or BlackBerry with Carbonite's free applications. Ooh. All this means you can focus on growing your business and leave the backup to Carbonite Pro. You can try Carbonite Pro for free for 30 days with prices starting at just $10 a month. More details and to sign up for that free 30 days, go to carbonitepro.com. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Let's talk about, well, I guess we've got another bit of Intel news here.
Sandy Bridge.
Not money, more about technology, which is always good. Intel is apparently, according to a story from PC World, ramping up Sandy Bridge, which is their next generation processor, for a quicker release than they had originally anticipated. That those kinds of things don't usually happen very often in the technology world, so it's always good when we can see things like that. For those of you who don't know, the kind of general overview of Sandy Bridge is that it is a single die chip now that will include graphics as well as the standard processor cores on a single die, as opposed to having them on separate chips, that type of thing. It's a 32 nanometer technology as well. According to this story, Intel started sending sample chips from the Sandy Bridge family to customers last quarter, giving them a chance to see what the chips can do, start building their systems around it, and that kind of thing. And let's see, what do they give for a date here? It looks like we should actually start seeing systems and products available before the end of the year. Originally, we were kind of predicting Q1 of 2011. Now that's being pulled into Q4 of 2010. So that's good. I mean, it's good news for everybody in terms of progression of technology, lowering prices of the current platform.
Does the Sandy Bridge architecture fall in between the Atom and the Core i3, or is it a Core i3 or an Atom?
Sandy Bridge is a overarching architecture like Nehalem was. So there will be super high-end parts with this architecture, mid-range, all the way down to what we know now as Core i3 and that kind of stuff. So I'd imagine we'll see everything from the $1,000 processor to the $100 processor using Sandy Bridge. Maybe not out of the gate, but within, you know, 3 to 6 months type of thing. So Sandy Bridge will be the replacement for Core i7, Core i5 parts. We don't know exactly what they're going to be named. There's rumors that they're going to be called Core i9 or something, Core i12. I don't really know where they're going with this, but
or Core 4000.
Core 4000, you know, something. Yeah, they'll come up with something that won't make any sense to anybody again, hopefully.
Kind of like the BMW naming system. It's kind of weird. Is just the architecture moving along so well, they feel like they can ramp it up early? I mean, that's just strange. Has Intel gotten so good at designing chips that things are moving, you know what I mean? Like nobody releases an architecture early.
So the only reason they would move ahead is two things. They would save money or they would make more money. And right. I think it's more along the lines of saving money, because as it stands now, the Core i5 and Core i3 parts that have integrated graphics with their standard processing cores, they have a 32 nanometer processor die on it and a 45 nanometer graphics and memory controller die on the same package.
This is all about getting everything on the 32 nanometer and maximizing the number of chips per wafer.
Correct. Okay. And we would think that would be less complicated in the manufacturing process, because you don't have to worry about putting two dies on a single substrate and that type of thing. It should be simpler, excuse me, as long as, you know, they're confident where their yields are and everything like that. And if they're moving schedules forward, that would definitely mean that they are more comfortable with their yields than they had anticipated. So they're like, okay, well, why not start moving things over and saving money for similar or better performing parts that will fit in the same processor socket, probably, that type of thing. So
it's makes sense.
All good news. Now, you posted a link in here, something about owning your cable modem. Is it time to upgrade? And this is something I'm interested about, because I've never owned my own cable modem. I've always just taken whatever the cable provider.
Do you know what you pay monthly for your cable modem?
$5 a month.
So $60 a year.
Yeah, I think it's $5 a month, something like that.
I've seen it anywhere from $3 to $6 a month. So let me pull up the Motorola.
And every time I see cable modems for sale, like at a Best Buy, I'm always like, man, who would want to buy a cable modem?
cheap people like me who are trying to keep...
I have seen benefits where if you can modify firmware and kind of, you know, get some extra added benefits out of it, I've never really kind of gone down that route. But you're saying there's also like a financial benefit to it.
For me it was purely the idea. It just, I could buy a cable modem for 60 months. Why on earth would I pay Comcast $5 or $6 a month for the privilege of renting a piece of hardware that's statistically incredibly unlikely to die barring a lightning strike? you know what I mean, like, you know, what's the last time you got an email, dude, my cable modem died, you know, what should I do? But it was interesting is there's three things coming about. Is because I, you know, was moving to, we're moving to a new apartment recently, had to get the cable moved over, and I just had been playing around with a upgrading to a DOCSIS 3 modem, because I have an older cable modem. And, you know, of course, upgrading to the DOCSIS 3 modem, and I got full performance out of my line finally. But it was interesting as part of that, as I was looking, like, okay, I was looking to replace my old cable modem. I stumbled across something I found again recently is mydeviceinfo.comcast.net, which is sort of a beta version, but it lists it's a beta of a website they're putting together, but basically it lists all of the cable modems that they know of and its current status. Most importantly, about whether it's DOCSIS. Pardon me, everybody. Whether it's DOCSIS 1, 2, or 3, and of course for the Blast Ultra at Extreme 50, you need a DOCSIS 3.0 modem. What also is interesting about it is there's a column all the way on the right of the page that is the end-of-life column. And it basically tells you when they stop supporting, because generally speaking, DOCSIS 3 modems, the firmware has to be pushed by the cable members, your MSO basically has to push the firmware updates to it. So you'll see, like, a lot of older modems have been end-of-life for one reason or another. So if you're wondering what's going on with your cable modem, or if you want to save yourself $60 a year, stick it to the man. which you know, may or may not appeal to anybody out there. It's worth taking some in, especially before you buy a cable modem, even used. Take a couple minutes to eyeball what's going on. If, and obviously, if Comcast is your cable provider, which it is for a lot of people, you know, I'm hoping that various and sundry other cable ISPs, cable-based ISPs, have similar easy access to the documentation on that.
Right.
Or at least easy access once you actually find the Comcast beta trial cable devices page buried deep, deep, deep within the heart.
Yeah, so I just checked my local internet provider, which I'm not very happy with right now, but you're stuck with the choices you got. Insight, cable modem purchase for $50 or cable modem rental for $3 a month. So those are the two options they give you for that. Now, one of the things... I think the days of this are done, where you could buy a modem, a cable modem, kind of do some hacking on it and get faster upload or download speeds.
Yeah.
I think those days are gone, correct?
Yeah. For, I mean, it may still be out there, partially because there's, you know, cable modems are kind of like set-top boxes, and then it's a very fragmented market. But cable modems, they have more in common than I think the cable boxes. The interesting thing about cable modems is they're all tested by cable labs. Everything's vetted through the industry testing operation, which is run through the cable labs. And I'm pretty sure they've done maybe the end of life models are the ones that might have firmware hacks or the possibility. The theory was that all of the bandwidth is available to every cable modem on the system, if you could trick the system into letting your cable modem have all the access you wanted. That's how it was explained to me once. It is theft of services. You can go to jail for stuff like that if Comcast is feeling bored and getting all RIAA on you. I've never seen anything in theory. Once you've got a DOCSIS 3 modem that is still supported, in theory, there's not going to be any performance difference between cable modems. I have never known anyone to actually test the reality of that, but at this point, I dare say it's a fairly, you know, because I'm looking at like this giant list of Motorola cable modems in the section in here. And, you know, at this point, the cable modem, the receiving end of the cable modem is pretty stone age in terms of technology. There's not a lot of bleeding. Nobody's putting 3.9 billion transistors in a cable modem to get it, you know, 200 kilobits per second more. You're pretty much getting your speed. So
it was, you know, for the hackers out there that don't mind the risk of going to jail, the days where you could get one of those illegal black boxes for your cable services and that kind of stuff, and same thing with your cable modem, all those days are done when they started moving all those controls to in-house as opposed to, you know, sitting outside your own house. So
figure. Have you thought about do you currently use a cable modem or do you use DSL for the service?
Cable at both my home and the office here.
Have you looked to see if there are any regional providers that do like ADSL 2 plus?
No, I have not.
I came really close. Unfortunately, it's not available in my particular neighborhood yet, but it was interesting. There's a regional DSL provider here in the Bay Area, and it's amazing to look at the ADSL 2 plus lets you get up to like 30 megabits per second down. The upload speeds aren't as hot. You're looking at like 1 to 2 megabits per second upload maximum. Okay. But you're talking about like if you do dual pair, there's no month. You basically don't need to have a phone line. You don't have to pay a monthly fee. But you're looking at 18 to 30 megabits per second as a maximum download speed.
I think right now what I'm waiting for is our local telco provider, Cincinnati Bell, is installing fiber throughout the region.
And
new telephone poles going in off the main road where I live, and I'm kind of hopeful that by the end of the year I'll get that magical email that says congrats, you know, I've signed up for their list to be notified when it's available probably 30 times.
Congratulations, Mr. Shroud, Cincinnati Bell. Fiber Service 4000 is available at your home. Should you choose to enlist in Fiber Service 4000? I'd go with fiber in a heartbeat if I ever lived anywhere where they actually pulled fiber to the houses.
It would be nice. You know what else would be nice? finally having a press conference to announce something about your phone that many people have been complaining about. So I'm sure most people who are listening to this, either live or if you're downloading it, this press conference has already happened. But Apple is holding a press conference about the iPhone 4 on Friday. We don't know exactly why. So there's rumors of a recall. I can't see that happening for any amount of pressure in the world. Will they announce that they're going to give everybody free bumper cases? Or, as I predict, will Steve Jobs stand up in front of everybody, give us the middle finger, and say, our phone works fine, you're all idiots?
Well, it's really funny, right? Because we're talking in Techzilla this week. Because of HTC is having supply issues, primarily with touchscreens, and they're looking for multiple vendors because it's like Samsung touchscreens are backordered, so they're short in supply on the Evo 4G, and I want to say the Incredible, which are two of the slickest, coolest, most amazing Android-based phones out there. The Droid X is out this week, and it's looking fantastic. Mm-hmm. I know Sasha Sagan over at PC Mag had a great write-up on it, was absolutely thrilled with it. If you're on Verizon, it's worth looking at. And Apple's been, you know, Apple, right, the Steve Jobs reality distortion machine. Apple has this highly groomed collection of very tame reviewers. You know, they've played around with some, you know, sort of expanding the group of reviewers, but they've gotten between like Anand's testing, Consumer Reports, who for people like to talk smack about Consumer Reports, but they are very old school and very hardcore. They have a, you know, basically a Faraday cage with a microcell in it. They do full on testing. They've verified that the dropouts exist with, you know, and you can detect them with the right equipment, and B, that the 4 point, because, you know, Apple's like, oh, no, you're not experiencing dropped calls. It's, you know, we talked about it with Anand, right? It's basically how the problem isn't dropped calls. The problem is that we're reporting too many bars when we, they're basically saying we're reporting too many bars, you know, and everybody's like, I can't say that phrase on a family-friendly show, but you all know what I was thinking. So, I mean, Dave Weiner, who's a big blogosphere, kind of like pundit guy, basically said that this, you know, Apple's comeuppance is coming. They've been too high-handed for too long. They have no idea how to basically respond appropriately. You know, there's been some legal action. There's class action lawsuits banding together because people are so upset about this, and lawyers smell money.
Yes, exactly.
But the end result of it is Apple sends out to its list of usual suspects that they're holding a press conference on the iPhone 4 on Friday. And, you know, yeah, it's either Steve says we're all insane or Apple does a recall, which is fiscally daunting. You know, Apple's got Apple's capitalization at this. Apple, who was 10 years ago, was a company that was basically gone, that everybody had written off, which now has a greater market capitalization than Microsoft, which is to say they're real popular on Wall Street. you know, they can't really afford $2 billion or $1.5 billion or whatever this insane number was to recall and swap all the phones, because essentially it means swapping an entirely new phone. This is like their version of the Toyota Accelerator, except, you know, stuck accelerators are a lot more serious than your iPhone.
It's a little more dangerous, than a phone issue.
You know, call me not much of a whiner, but the and that's not a Dave Weiner reference, by the way, but the it's going to be interesting to see what they say. Will they give everyone bumpers? Is it going to be like bring it to an Apple store and we'll shellac the outside of the case? Will it be a cheaper version of the bumper? I think it's going to be really interesting. The thing I'm most curious about is whether or not, if it is a kind of negative, like dealing with the problem, is will it be Steve dealing with the problem on stage? You know, if it's kind of like bad news and it's not Steve, man, there's going to be people are just going to explode on the Twitter.
I would be surprised if he were actually the one up there delivering. If there's bad news, I would be surprised if he were the one up there.
I would be pleased if he was willing to deliver the bad news.
I would be as well, but I would be surprised.
You're not holding your breath. So, Yeah, that's it's going to be interesting. Should we fire up the Twitter questions? Speaking of the Twittersphere going nuts, can we say that Twittersphere?
Twittersphere. Twittersphere. I don't want to get into those kind of terms. we can jump into those. That's not an issue. Let's see. Our first one, Zabelbach, says, "Hi, fellas. Is investing money in a Corsair H50 cooler worth it? Thanks." Have you used any of these before?
I've used similar products, and my gut response is no. Buy yourself a big boy, assemble it with tubing. There are some. It's basically a pre-assembled, relatively inexpensive pre-assembled water cooler. So it's got a little tiny, like 4-inch radiator with a fan bolted to it, and it's cabled up with this fairly burly look, and it looks like plastic coated Romex going to the heat sink, basically the water block that clamps down in your CPU.
Right.
This one may be better than some of the other ones I've seen that look like this, but generally speaking, these kind of prefabbed ones do not deliver the kind of performance I would like to see. That said, I have not seen testing for this one, so maybe this one's better than some of the other ones I've seen.
It's not. It's not particularly better performing than some of the other all-in-one self-contained kind of CPU water coolers, where this is not an expandable system. You've got your water block and pump on one single unit that rests on the processor and mounts to the processor, and then you've got your tubing to a radiator with a 120 millimeter fan, or fan. Now, I agree with you. It's not going to be nearly as good of a performer as running your own water block, getting a Coolance set up, setting up a big triple rad at the top of your system. But what I have been very impressed with is how low cost these have gotten. I believe I saw the Corsair H50 selling for $48.99 after a rebate last week, which it's basically the same price as a high-end air cooler. Like maybe if you get a Thermalright 120 heat sink or something like that with a nice big quiet fan, then you are looking at very, very similar prices. But the Corsair H50 or the Coolit ALC unit, and they have another one out as well that's very, very similar to it, they're going to perform a little bit better. They're going to be a little bit quieter. And overall, I think it's kind of like of a... I don't know. It's more geeky, enthusiast-like type product to have than just I've got a heatsink and a fan in there.
I mean, I hate to slag on because I haven't tested the Corsair H50, but I tested a similar. Generally speaking, the water blocks I saw on the integrated pump water block were atrocious. And I guess my issue is that because I'm trying to find a particular. You never actually find the one air cooler you're looking for, because I'm on frozencpu.com and there's like 3,000 air coolers.
Right.
My concern is now that there's these $50 air coolers that have absolutely fantastic performance that's basically rivaling water blocks at this point. The fans are relatively quiet. I'm like, if you're going to bother – at this point, I think if you're going to bother to – put water cooling in your system, and I have a water cooled system, I think you need to really get a solid, looking at the Swiftex stuff, looking at some of the other stuff out there, because my issue is that the Core i7 throws off a lot of heat, and especially if you're overclocking, and the thermals basically, if you don't pull all the heat off of the Core i7 processor, right? I got a Core i7 920. It was the entry level processor when I bought it. It's fantastic overclocking part, right? But if you don't keep the thermals down, it'll bump up to 100 degrees centigrade, and then it'll roll off your clock speed to reduce the amount of heat that's being generated. So in my case, I started playing around with these, and like, I went up to a much better water block, I had built a thing on system a couple of years ago where, for my own personal amusement, I took the radiator off of a V6 Dodge minivan or something. So I had this gigantic, I had, I nice. had, I, I had this basically this gigantic electric fan integrated into a radiator bolted on the side of the Zantec case. So I had a huge volume of water, number one, a huge volume of water, and two, a huge radiating surface to dissipate any heat. But even with this gigantic radiator and this huge volume of fluid, this little cheap little water block couldn't move enough water efficiently enough across the surface of the CPU to actually dissipate the kind of thermals right. needed to have it run efficiently. So, you know, I want to say go for a more, you know, see if who's tested stuff, but I'm really saying spend a little bit more money and get a much better water block and a much better pump. It's a pain to have a separate pump and configure it.
Yes, but it is.
Performance is going to be so much better.
I can't argue with performance being so much better, but
it's certainly much harder to do.
Right. The point about it being harder and easier, like yeah. I built a computer for our office. And the only thing in it that was loud was this old Zalman heatsink, and I was putting it's like a Core 2 Q6600, not that old, but it wasn't being used for anything. So I said, all right, I'll put one of these in there. And I happened to have an H50 sitting around that we had reviewed, but hadn't actually used yet. And I just popped it in there, and now it's, you know, it's nice and quiet and silent, and I don't have to worry about the temperatures and that kind of stuff either. So. You know, if it's something where you think you might want to expand on water cooling later, then definitely go with what Patrick is saying here, because you have a lot more flexibility with those types of things as well. We use both here in our testing. You want to take our next question here from Jay in Tracks,
for gaming, is the GTX 465 a worthy upgrade from the 9800 GX2 with an AMD X2 3.2 gigahertz, 4 gigabit? Okay, AMD 3.2 gigahertz AMD X2 processor, 4 gigabytes of RAM, I'm assuming, 800 megahertz yeah. front side bus. Yep. Basically, it's get a GTX 465 or wait and do a whole new system. I'm thinking wait for a whole new system, or unless he wants to upgrade the graphics card and then turn around and upgrade the motherboard and the CPU and probably the memory in a few months.
Yeah, the AMD X2 processor is, it's running at 3.2, so it's relatively high end. It's still somewhat dated. The 9800 GX2, that's an interesting graphics card because it's a dual GPU graphics card, but it's dual 9800. So it's right. Technically we're two architectures past that, two full architectures, probably, you know, 3 years or more past it. I would say that the GTX 465 would be probably an upgrade in performance, but it wouldn't be super dramatic over that. The 465, we didn't really talk about it a whole lot because when the 460 is out, the 465 is essentially done. What's out there in the market, they're going to continue to sell, obviously. But once they're gone type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I would look at either getting, you know, one of the higher overclock 460s or maybe even a 470 if you could spend another $80-$90 or so, and then see, you know, if you're gonna wait and get a whole new system, then you're gonna have to buy a new graphics card anyway. So if you're gonna, might as well buy a new graphics card now and see if that gives you a significant enough performance advantage over your current configuration. Otherwise, if it doesn't, then you know you'll have to upgrade your processor and motherboard and that kind of stuff. So right. It sounds to me like you're either going to buy all of it or some of it now and more of it later. Yeah. I don't think there's nothing kind of right around the horizon in terms of graphics cards that will change your mind likely and probably in the next 4 to 6 months. You know, I can't say that with any certainty, that I don't know everybody's roadmaps exactly, but I think what we'll see is what's out there now. And obviously you'll see prices kind of come down as time goes by, but I don't think we're going to see anything super dramatic and changing in the world of graphics cards for at least a little bit. So worthy upgrade is hard to wade. It's hard to gauge being everybody's system is a little bit different and what components are the bottlenecks and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the things we're doing some benchmarking, playing around and trying to figure out whether or not the favorite video games you either want to play at a higher resolution or can't play, period, at a usable resolution, and figuring out whether that game is primarily GPU or CPU bound, in the sense that, you know, a lot of video games tend to be more intensive on one and the other. Although in the last couple of years, it seems like they're pretty intensive on everything anymore.
Yeah, so. Actually, StarCraft II testing we're doing here, it turns out that if you are running, if you're doing a map that has eight players on it, and you have, you know, several hundred units running around doing all the, you know, the different actions, it becomes much more of a CPU limited scenario than GPU limited scenario. So, right. I mean, there's a lot of kind of back and forth in there. It depends on what games you're playing and all kinds of different things. But still, I would say it's more GPU limited than CPU limited. Most of the time. So let's see. Our last Twitter question comes from No Touch Snickers, which is kind of funny. Looking to build a new system with dual GTX 260s, and I was going to do an i7-930. Should I wait for Intel Sandy Bridge, though?
I'm always good. I'm sorry. I was like, wait. Always wait, because every time you wait 6 months, you get twice the graphics performance for the same money or less.
I assume he meant GTX 460s.
That's true.
First of all, just to clarify, because GTX 260s are
creme de la creme of what, 2005?
Yeah, maybe 2007 or something. 260s aren't that old. So 260s and 280s. You know, I mean, if he's actually building it based on dual 260s, that just means he has an existing configuration. But if he's building a whole new rig, I assume he meant 460s. So you say you would wait. I would say like the present, I guess.
You're also the guy who has how many monitors in his office right now? And you test hardware for a living. So, you know, I mean, it's funny, right? I lived on $500 PCs for the better part of 10 years. And, you know, last year I built this badass, for me, you know, high performance. Because basically, like, I'm like, I need to rip, you know, close to 1,000 CDs and several hundred DVDs and a whole bunch of Blu-rays, and I want a gigantic processor. And so, you know, for me, that was the Core i7-920 and 12 gigabytes of RAM, and I've got an SSD drive, and I'm about ready to do a graphics card upgrade. But, you know, with PC parts, if you can wait... Waiting a few months can often get you a big old chunk of performance and save you some coin in the process. You know, if you can limp along with your current system, at least you can find out what the Sandy Bridge stuff is and see whether or not it's a decent improvement. Plus, when the new processors come out and new GPUs come out, all the existing stuff gets pushed down in price. You know, don't get me wrong, I don't want to halt the economy because people aren't, I don't want to screw up Intel's Q4 or Q3 because I told people to wait to buy, you know, CPUs and GPUs.
Yeah, they're going to blame you for this.
Yeah, I'm going to get a personal letter from Intel. You know, but yeah, if you can wait, you know, especially like hard drives too at this point, just leap in ridiculous ways. 3 terabyte hard drives are out, you know, months before anybody expected it from Seagate of all people. Yeah, you know, I'm going to say sit back, save up some more money, keep an eye on what's coming down the pipeline. I'm patient that way.
Titus in the chat room actually had a suggestion that if he's while he's waiting, maybe overclock the existing rig a little bit, spend a little time playing with it. We could even say that to the guy in the previous question. Maybe try overclocking that Athlon X2 processor to 3.8 gigahertz or something like that. What, you know, do some research and forums and all that kind of stuff and figure out what is safe and capable of it's running at and play around with that a little bit.
Definitely. So, Thermalright Coach Gauge True Spirit, by the way, was the air cooled.
And how much is that?
It's down to $40 now.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic cooler. Kyle over at Hard OCP, his crew did a pretty good write up on that. And it's a ridiculously, the Coach Gauge True Spirit is basically Thermalright engineering. It's a ridiculously inexpensive really nice air-based cooler. But yeah, I'm actually redoing the water cooling in my system because the little, you know, the water blocks that I have with the integrated pumps just aren't moving enough heat off the CPU. I'm also trying to overclock a Core i7 920 by 30%. So my thermals are a little ridiculous at this point.
Thanks.
Maybe I'm just too extreme.
Hey, there's no such thing as too extreme. But just don't bring down the whole economy because you want people to wait for their upgrades, all right?
Ladies and gentlemen, mortgage yourselves to the hilt, sell the cat, and scrimp on the children's education. Buy yourself new computers now because America needs your dollars.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself. All the companies involved will appreciate your taking on their stance behind everything. All right. Well, I think that is going to round up our show for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening, watching live. If you want to watch us record the show live, you can do so every, Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. And you see, for me, I'm Ryan Trout. You can find my work and the stuff that I do at PC Perspective, which can be found at pcper.com. And if you want to participate in our Twitter questions, you should follow me on Twitter, just at Ryan Shroud. I'm not very creative that way. And usually sometime on Thursday, I will ping everybody who's following me and say, hey, if you've got questions for This Week in Computer Hardware, let us know. Now, Patrick, where can we look to find you other than this one here?
Techzilla, TEKZILLA.com. It's the show I host with Veronica Belmont. We're all about all kinds of tech, software, hardware, toys, gadgets, goodies, how to make your stuff work better, and how to buy the best new stuff. And of course, HD Nation with Robert Herron is a show we do where it's all about high definition content and home theater gear. And the reason my eyes keep glancing down is because I found my water block, my own personal water block, which is an EK Supreme HF Universal, which I dropped much more than the $80 that it currently costs at frozencpu.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get that a lot. That is the downside of being tech enthusiasts, I guess. So
I'm telling you, that is a fantastic water block if you want to really suck the heat out of something. So
sounds good.
I basically have to patch that into my Blackbird case while still using the integral reservoir / radiators inside of that. I'll take pictures for next week.
Do that. Take pictures. We like pictures. Pictures and videos we can do. All right. So thank you guys again, everybody. And we will see you next week on Twitch.